Beacon Press Audio presents Being Human, an unrepentant memoir of a disability rights activist by Judith Heumann with Kristen Joyner. This audiobook is narrated by Ali Stroker, published by Beacon Press Audio, 2020.
A note from Judy. For a long time, I resisted the idea of writing my story. Not because I was afraid of revisiting these memories, although it has been difficult at times, I admit, but rather because I have never felt like it was my story alone to tell. Everything I've done in my life, I never would have been able to do alone. Whether it was my mother and father, or my brothers, my friends from school, or my fellow activists helping, listening, laughing, and leading. I have felt their love and support whispering in my ear throughout this entire process, and I hope my story allows them to shine in the way I remember them. At times, I have changed the names of people and certain details for the sake of privacy and recreated some situations based on my memory and the memory of those around me. And so, with that caveat, I share with you my story. Thank you for listening. Prologue. I never wished I didn't have a disability. I'm fairly certain my parents didn't either. I never asked them, but if I had, I don't think they would have said that our lives would have been better if I hadn't had a disability. They accepted it and moved forward. That was who they were. That was their way. They deliberately decided not to tell me what the doctor had advised when I recovered from polio, and it became clear I was never going to walk again. It wasn't until I was in my 30s that I discovered what he'd suggested. "I recommend that you place her in an institution," he said. It wasn't personal. It didn't have anything to do with our family being German immigrants, nor was it ill-intentioned. I am sure he sincerely believed that the very best thing for these young parents to do would be to have their 2-year-old child raised in an institution. In many ways, institutionalization was the status quo in 1949. Parents weren't necessarily even encouraged to visit their institutionalized children. Kids with disabilities were considered a hardship economically and socially. They brought stigma to the family. People thought that when someone in your family had a disability, it was because someone had done something wrong. I don't know how my parents responded to the doctor, because my family didn't talk a lot about things like this. But I'm sure my parents would have found the idea of putting me in an institution very disturbing. Both my mother and my father had been made orphans by the Holocaust. As teenagers, they'd been sent to the United States. It was the time when Hitler was coming into power, when things were getting bad enough that people worried about the safety of their children, but didn't think it was going to get as bad as it did. My father came to live with an uncle in Brooklyn at 14, and he was lucky that his 3 brothers followed very soon after. My mother was an only child and was sent alone to live in Chicago with someone she didn't know at all. The story was that a distant relative came from the States to visit my mother's family in Germany and brought news of the worsening situation. The information convinced my grandparents to send my mother, their one child, away to live with this distant relative. I have often imagined what it must have felt like for my mother. You're 12 years old, and one day, someone you don't know, someone you've never met before, comes to visit your family, and 2 weeks later, you're suddenly gone from Germany forever, living alone in Chicago with unfamiliar people. My mother always thought that her family would be together again. Even during the war, she was working to save money to bring her parents over. Only later did she learn that they'd been killed. If I'd been born just 10 years earlier and become disabled in Germany, it is almost certain that the German doctor would also have advised that I be institutionalized. The difference is that instead of growing up being fed by nurses in a small room with white walls and a roommate, I would have been taken to a special clinic, and at that special clinic, I would have been killed. Before Auschwitz and Dachau, there were institutions where disabled children were eliminated. Hitler's pilot project for what would ultimately become mass genocide started with disabled children. Doctors encouraged the parents to hand their young children over to specially designated pediatric clinics where they were either intentionally starved or given a lethal injection. When the program expanded to include older children, the doctors experimented with gassing. 5,000 children were murdered in these institutions. The Nazis considered people with disabilities a genetic and financial burden on society, life unworthy of life. So when an authority figure in their new country, a doctor, said to my parents, "We will take your daughter out of your home and raise her," they never would have agreed to it. They came from a country where families got separated, some children sent away, others taken from their families by the authorities and never returned, all as part of a campaign of systematic dehumanization and murder. Their daughter, disabled or not, wasn't going anywhere. Parents weren't obstinate or anti-authoritarian. They were thinkers. They had learned what happens when hatred and inhumanity are accepted. Both my father and my mother were brave people who lived by their values. They had personally experienced what happens when an entire country chooses not to see something simply because it is not what they wish to see. And as a result, they never accepted anything at face value. When something doesn't feel right, they taught us, you must question it. Whether it is an instruction from an authority or what a teacher says in class. At the same time, my parents didn't dwell on the past or on things that were done to them. They didn't forget the past, and they definitely learned from it. But Ilse and Werner Human moved forward, especially Ilse. She was an optimist and a fighter, and so am I. I can't say I was thinking about all these things when we took over the San Francisco Federal Building, or even when I took on the New York City Board of Education. Only now, looking back, can I see how it all came together to turn me into the person I was to become. Part 1. Brooklyn, New York, 1953. Chapter 1. The Butterfly. Some people say that what I did changed the world. But really, I simply refused to accept what I was told about who I could be. And I was willing to make a fuss about it. I must say right up front, though, that it wasn't actually an I, it was a we. For any story of changing the world is always the story of many. Many ideas, many arguments, many discussions, many late night, punchy, falling apart, laughing brainstorms, many believers, many friendships, many failures, many times of almost giving up, and many, many, many people. This is my story, yes, but I was one in a multitude, and I hope I will do justice to the many heroes, those who are alive and those no longer among us. To begin at the beginning, I will tell you about what happened after my parents refused to institutionalize me, about my childhood. So you will understand what the world was like then. Before we took over the San Francisco Federal Building, before people crawled up the steps of the Capitol, before systemic change began. In 1953, I was 6. Dwight D. Eisenhower was president. Elizabeth Taylor was a box office star. Jackie Robinson had just recently broke the color line in baseball. And World War II had ended a mere 8 years earlier. Elvis Presley had 3 years to go before his breakthrough on the Ed Sullivan Show. The Dodgers were still in Brooklyn, and much of America, celebrating the advent of peace and prosperity, was in the throes of having 7 million babies, the baby boom. Less obvious than the general sense of prosperity was the discontent that simmered below the surface among the people living lives segregated from the wealth of post-World War II America. Whether African Americans, Latinos, or other minorities. In 1953, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was in the midst of taking its class action suit, Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, to the Supreme Court. 2 years later, Rosa Parks would refuse to give up her seat to a white passenger on a Montgomery, Alabama bus. To my parents, the events of their new country were of great interest, and they, along with all the other immigrants of our Brooklyn neighborhood, followed the news closely. I, on the other hand, at 6, understood very little of the national news, but from my 6-year-old perspective, I could have told you a great deal about what life was like for someone like me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?